You are listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM in the Brighton area and RadioReverb.com online. Welcome to the UK's only radio show about HIV and living a healthy life. It's the HIV Hour. On today's show, we feature a rundown of the latest news and talking points about living with HIV from the Brighton area and the world at large. Also, information on Brighton's HIV organisations and some other events. Do email us at hivhour@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @HIV_hour and Instagram at @HIVHour. If you miss the show on a Thursday at 7 p.m, then you can listen again at 4 p.m. on Monday and at noon on Tuesday, or indeed catch up with an older show by going to the Listen Again page on RadioReverb.com.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Hello.
All right. Yes, we're back, aren't we?
We're back.
Yes.
Have we ever been away, though? Have we ever been away?
With the fairies.
Yeah. We've gone to the fairies.
Yeah.
Hope everyone's all right at home, listening in. And yes, we'll do a round robin, see how everyone is today. Well, who shall I start with? I'll start with me.
Go on.
I'm all right. Yes, not too bad. Yeah, that's about it, really.
Well, you're laughing. That's good, isn't it? Yeah.
You're not too bad.
Fine, yes. Isn't it?
Yes. How are you, David?
I'm good. I went to choose some new kittens last week. So.
Yay!
Fabulous.
Eight little paws scampering around.
Oh, lovely.
Ooh, we'll be round. We'll be round, won't we, Stephen?
Yeah, definitely.
Have you got, when did you get them, David?
Middle of October.
Yeah, oh, lovely.
So. Oh, fab.
Trained by then, but yeah, I've got a boy and a girl this time.
Ooh.
Have a big one. And yourself, Sue?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yes. I'm going to mention work again because listeners will probably think, oh, that's all she always bangs on about. Yeah, but it's important work, isn't it, guys? I've just been quite busy. With lots of stuff going on with the Terence Higgins Trust, and I think we're going to talk about the 40th anniversary gala later on, and you know how I sort of spoke about the HIV Hour at the event. So work is just, we mentioned World AIDS Day. You know, we're getting ready for the run up to the biggest event of the year on the HIV calendar. So not wishing the months away, but we're soon going to be there. So, yeah. So, apart from that, I'm okay.
Nights are drawing in.
Yeah, the nights are getting in, yeah.
They are. It's getting cold again.
It is. Yeah. Got me woolens on. Yeah. The long johns.
Woolen underwear.
Me woolens. How about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. 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 Missed everybody.
We missed you.
Not seen your lovely fleeces.
Because you've been away, haven't you?
Yeah. I went away for a week, so that was nice. Mm-hmm. And so just back to normality, back to talks with the Terence Higgins Trust and other things. And so just keeping busy.
How's that going? How's that going, Stephen?
It's gone well. It's always really interesting going into different schools and working out who your audience are and what's going to work with them, so sometimes you have to kind of adapt your story just to make sure you're hitting on the points that are going to be relevant to your audience. It's always good fun, and it's always I always feel as if I've done something worthwhile after I've done a talk.
Yeah, so, makes you feel good. Makes you feel good.
Yeah, definitely. So
what we got on the show? Yeah, I beat you to it, Josh. What we got on the show this week?
Well, I'm having an interview with a guy called Mark Ward, who's been on the show before, actually. And he's he was an hemophiliac. And he's been living with that since the blood scandal, actually. And he's been on the show and talked about it before, but I think recently there's been an update of it, hasn't there? People got awarded some money. So I had a chat with him and just to see how it's progressing and how he feels and that. So that's on next. I'm just got some world stories as well and some community news later, haven't we? depending around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the HIVR on 97.2 FM in the BrightonArea.com online, and you can always locate our famous podcasts. As you mentioned, Josh, I was honoured actually to talk a fairly prestigious event last week. It was the Terence Higgins Trust commemorating 40 years. Can you believe this charity has been going 40 years since the death of the patron of Terry Higgins? So basically the event was held in London in a beautiful building, which I had an honour to stand up and speak in. It was the Royal Naval College, in the particular venue that we were, that the celebration was, it was at the Painted Rooms. Now, this is, if you've ever been to Italy and seen the Sistine Chapel, it was like that. It was absolutely extraordinary. So basically this was about all the patrons, all the people that have helped and supported at the Terence Higgins Trust to, you know, fund various projects over the year, you know, kept us going through incredibly difficult times. And so it was a thank you for them, and obviously a thank you for saying, can you please continue to support us? And there were some amazing stars there. I had an interview with the Radio 1 DJ, and I forgot her name now, Adele. So basically she is a quite famous Radio 1 DJ, and she interviewed me and also one of my other colleagues, Oliver Brown. And that was quite fantastic, because she obviously read my bio, and the first thing she said to me, she said, Sue, tell us about this amazing radio station in Brighton. So of course I give it a massive plug, you know. Mm-hmm. I said to everybody, I said, I don't know whether you're aware, but as far as I'm concerned, the HIVR is the only radio show dedicated to HIV. So I give them all the details. So that was really nice of Adele to sort of start off with that. And obviously I spoke about, you know, a bit about my story and what we need to do to end HIV transmission by 2030. And I left them with some really poignant messages. And then Ollie, he done his bit as well. And it was an amazing evening. I had the honour of meeting Sunita. She's tiny, this lady, Sunita. I don't know. She's just, you know, they're all...
A macho, isn't she?
She's like, oh, God, I thought of that. I told her I'm going to break. I know she's beautiful, beautifully. And I met the Scissor Sisters were singing. Yeah, that was brilliant. And some bands from the 80s, which 70s and 80s, which were out at my street. But the idea, the whole thing was that it was a celebration of the 40 years of the Terence Higgins Trust and celebrating the work we've done. But obviously, yet there's still the work left to do. But I felt honoured being asked to come and do a talk to, there was about 300 people there, and I've done some big things before, but afterwards people were coming up to me, and a lot of guys, they were coming up to me and they were saying, you know, Sue, we've never had anything like this before at this sort of event. We've always had men stand up. And I suppose a woman living with HIV, they were saying is an incredible impact. So I felt incredibly honoured. So yeah, it was. I'm sort of still coming down from it, as you can imagine. But there's still, you know, there's still a lot of work to do. But you know, it was a wonderful evening, dare I say. So yes.
And you looked very glamorous, Sue.
Did I?
Oh,
I
did. Yes. Yes.
Did we saw the pictures?
A showstopper. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you did. You did. We were impressed.
Oh, lovely. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you.
Well, it highlights, doesn't it, how far we've come and yes, how these yeah charities and organisations work, and how they're still working and adapting to situations, and how we're progressing, isn't it, I suppose? Well,
just quickly, I'll tell you who else is there, which I've got a lovely photo with. Emily Samson, you know, the singer.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, so yes, so yeah.
Great. Did you mention me?
Pardon?
Did you mention me?
And Josh was watching as well.
Sorry. Do you know you got interviewed by the Radio 1 DJ? Can you listen to that on BBC Sounds, or do you know?
I'm not sure. I'll find out.
Not sure. Yeah, because that'd be some people might want to listen to it, don't they?
Yeah. If you say no, you're recognised, and I can't for the light of me. I've had a really busy day, and I just can't remember her name. But yeah, she was lovely, and she posted something fantastic on Twitter. And we were sitting underneath these beautiful portraits on the wall, and she's put a Twitter tag on it, in the presence of angels. And I didn't really understand what she meant to start with, but I suppose it was beautiful. It was really sort of touched me. So yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So shall we listen to the interview I did with Mark Ward?
HIVR is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
So, welcome back to the HIV Hour, 97.2 FM, DAB Plus and RadioReverb.com. So in the 1970s and 80s, there's around 4,700 people with bleeding disorders were affected with HIV and hepatitis C in the UK, most of whom had haemophilia. So as of August 22, at least 2,400 people have died from the use of contaminated blood on the scandal. So now the government has offered an interim compensation payment of £100,000 to anyone who was affected or registered on the UK affected blood support scheme. So I'm really glad to have in with us on the show Mark Ward, who's been on the show before and told his story. But I think it'd be really good to get Mark's perspective again on the judgment and how it's going and what's coming along, really. So how are you, Mark?
Hello, Josh. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
That's all right. You're welcome. It's always nice.
Yes, thank you. Could you just, to remind listeners who maybe haven't listened to that show, just your story and how we got to this point here?
Yeah, okay. So I was born with a bleeding disorder, which is called haemophilia. The most famous one is Queen Victoria's grandson. He had haemophilia, and the mad monk Rasputin was the one who cared for him. So that's what it's famous for, and known as the royal disease. It basically means if I cut myself or I bang myself, where a healthy person would just get a bruise, or say if you get a shaving cut, the nick, it stops, it scabs over.
Yeah.
Mine doesn't. Mine just keeps bleeding. It doesn't spurt everywhere. It isn't just, you know, like somebody's cut my head off. It just doesn't stop.
Just continual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The problem is that if you bang your head, it can be fatal. Even being sick, because the action of the retching can cause stomach bleeds. For severe haemophiliacs like myself, it's really the joint damage, because when you get a bleed into your knee or your elbow or something, it basically pushes the joint apart, right, with the build-up of blood until the bleeding is stopped. And the way they stop that is by using treatment.
Yeah.
And in the 1970s and 80s, they were using whole blood. And what they do is they would take, it's not like when you think of a blood transfusion. A blood transfusion is one pint of blood, and somebody, say, who's had an operation, you've got that stereotypical picture of the bag of blood on the drip stand going in. That's a transfusion. Now, what they would do to make haemophilia and bleeding disorder products is they would take up to 60,000 of those bags of blood, put them all into a big vat, mix it all around, and then they would put it through a process where they extract the fatturate and the different proteins to make the different products.
Right.
So, of course, the thing is, when you've got 60,000 bags, you only need a couple of viruses in there, and every single bottle that is then manufactured and sent around the world is contaminated.
Right.
So we're talking millions and millions of units.
Yeah.
Add into the equation that here in the UK, despite the AIDS crisis officially beginning in 1982, they continue to harvest blood from borstals and prisons here.
Right.
And what they did was, even when they stopped harvesting the blood in 1984, the blood they had harvested, they had frozen. So it was still being used into the 1980s.
Yeah.
However, in America, what they were doing, because they're paid donors, they were preying on the vulnerable.
Okay.
So you've got homeless people, you've got drug addicts, you've got alcoholics, prostitutes, all those people that are living on right on the edge of society who are selling their blood for either their fix or to for food.
Yeah.
And they would go from blood centre to blood centre donating their blood. And the thing is that if you are collecting your blood from unhealthy people, because they've not got a good diet, you know, if somebody's homeless, they're not in a great state of health.
Yeah, sure.
So
yeah.
The blood, the quality of the blood they're then being paid for, it can be, it's not good, but actually then it you run the risk of anything being in there.
And it's passing that on.
And it's passing that on. So all of those donations, they were also on an industrial scale, they were harvesting the blood from prisons in America. And in fact, there's the famous Arkansas prison where they actually built a factory unit on the side of the prison so they could process more prisoners quickly. So they literally drained the prisoner, the blood went through the process and bottled within the same building and out. And they found that if they didn't put any safety protocols or measures in place, like heat treating it to kill viruses, they could make more, they got more yield from it. So basically more yield means more dollars. More dollars means prizes.
More money.
More money.
Yeah, it's power, isn't it?
And money is power, exactly. Yeah. So one thing I would say is we live in 2022, the 21st century, where disability is thankfully seen differently in this country, and we're making ways forward.
Yeah, yeah.
But back in the 60s, the 70s, somebody like myself, as labelled with being disabled, you were written off. So they didn't give a damn about my education. I spent more time in hospital.
Mm.
Ministers in the British government, they would quote things like, oh, the life of a haemophiliac is an expensive one to maintain. Oof. You know, like an old vintage car or something.
It's discriminatory.
Yeah. We were sent to special schools. So the way that society viewed disabled people was that we were worthless cripples and we were never going to amount to anything. So with these people making vast amounts of money, they didn't care about the end user, some poor little soul in Aberystwyth, you know, who was being injected because he was kicking a football around and gave himself a bleed in his ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're talking about. Yeah. So little boys and teenagers and family men with haemophilia, all of a sudden when these products came across from America, the Factor VIII products, they started doing things like teeth extraction. And miraculously, across the United Kingdom, a lot of haemophiliacs suddenly needed four teeth taken out, or tonsillectomies. Research now shows that the tonsil tissue and the pulp from the teeth, they can actually see how virally impacted you are. So there was a lot of research going on as well.
Yeah.
And what makes it awful for me, as a gay man, proud gay man, with haemophilia, I've actually seen the discrimination from both sides. On the day that I was told I had HIV, it wasn't where I went and had a test and everything was known and we had counselling or anything like that. It wasn't. I'd spent 6 weeks in hospital following knee surgery, and I was at age 14.
And that would have been an awful experience as well, wouldn't it? I'm just having the knee surgery.
But to leading up to that, because of my haemophilia, my left knee was so badly damaged that it was giving way. And the doctors said to me, if they didn't do the operation, I would be in a wheelchair by the time I was 21.
Right.
So it was either wheelchair or have this operation. So at that point in time, being a kid, I had it done. And it was as my parents were taking me home, they were wheeling me through the reception of the haemophilia unit at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And one of the haemophilia sisters popped up from behind a hatch and just shouted across the waiting room with people sitting there, Mr. and Mrs. Ward, do you want to know Mark's HIV result? And my parents just sort of looked at each other and went, yeah. So she said, positive, see you next time.
Oh, dear.
And it was just that throwaway comment, like, yeah. What do you want for dinner, peas or beans? Yeah. Oh, HIV, positive, bye.
And also in front of other people.
Yeah. There was no thought, and you don't need to be a medical professional to know that you don't do that sort of thing. But that's exactly what happened. And then the following week, I had to go back because of them monitoring after the surgery. And the consultant then was completely different. And she told us, you tell nobody because we can't guarantee your safety. In America, haemophiliacs were being shot at. Their homes were being set on fire. They were being attacked. Here in the UK, we had some similar episodes where family cars were burnt out. I'm very good friends with a family from Wales where their little boy got HIV through the Factor VIII, and they woke up one morning to somebody had written AIDS scum across the front of their house.
Is this recently?
This was back in the 80s.
Right.
Yeah, late 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
But this conversation with my consultant was 1984.
Right.
And at no point during the 6 weeks of my admission did they even say to my mum and dad, I was in danger, I was at risk, can we test? I was just secretly tested without consent and then broadcast to the public that I was positive. They told my mum and dad, just basically make the most of it. If he's lucky, he's got 2, maybe 3 years to live. And I came out of there and had to go back to school.
Oh, you know, it's like, all that information, all that in your head.
So yeah. Why go to school when you're being told you're going to die? Just everything really... I can't say everything changed. It did change. It was just, I was careful in what I did. I became very fearful of getting close to people.
Yeah.
I was terrified somebody in the school would find out. And even that was another layer of complexity, because my mum had to go to the school every week to speak to the headmaster. And the headmaster allowed me to remain in the school only with the pretext that if nobody complained, I could stay.
Right.
And the problem is, because having the haemophilia, all the kids that I actually started school with, I was the first, where my parents live in Hertfordshire, I was the first severe haemophiliac to go to a normal school.
Right.
So there was all measures put in place, and basically everybody had to know not to hit me or punch me or push me because I would get hurt. And now it's been broadcast that as part of what they called the 3H club, the homosexuals, the heroin addicts and the haemophiliacs, they're the people who got AIDS. So the whole school and their families and everybody knew me. So all of a sudden I went from being the kid that you had to look after and protect to the kid with the target on his back. So,
and the focus was on you.
It was, yeah.
And saying that, so that happened to how many people was affected by that?
So
I say 4,700, but there's a few more, wasn't it?
There was almost 5,000 haemophiliacs in the UK who were infected with hepatitis C.
Right.
And on top of that, there was 1,249 who also contracted HIV. That's the haemophilia community. There were then some people outside, so as I said, blood transfusion. We're not too sure of figures with that because it's actually impossible to ever know. But some people would have been given contaminated blood to save their life from an operation, and they didn't survive. So, or it might be mothers. They gave mothers a pint of blood as a tonic after giving birth. They sent them home with a newborn baby and hepatitis C. Oh. And then some of those mums then just lived with it for years and become very ill and died. So trying to trace people has been really difficult.
So coming up to the present day now, there's this compensation, which is an interim payment. We have to say that, don't we? So
yes, yeah.
Could you say a bit about that and what?
Yes. So the ongoing infected blood inquiry, which is the British the biggest public inquiry in British history, I'm the core participant in that, and the Penny Mordaunt, who was the Paymaster General, she set a task to Sir Robert Francis QC to build a study or do a study on a compensation framework. He made a recommendation that all people infected alive should receive an interim payment of £100,000.
Yeah.
The recommendation was put forward by Sir Brian Langstaff, who is the chair of the inquiry. The government accepted that in full. So, as one of the living infected, I will receive £100,000. They said it will be paid by the end of October, but okay, so far nobody's received a penny yet. They also extended it to bereaved partners.
Right.
So it doesn't include people like my mum, who's been there all the way. It doesn't include the children of those bereaved, you know, who sat and watched them, their dad or their mum pass away. It leaves a lot out, but it's the crucial part is the interim bit.
Yes.
We can't preempt what a public inquiry is going to say.
Excuse me, I'm going to call.
Can't preempt what a public inquiry is going to say, but because it's the interim, it suggests that proper compensation is actually on its way, and that will take into account everything. I mean, for my own personal story, despite being told I was going to die and it was the end of the world, I just didn't accept it, and I carried on trying to fulfil my dreams and live my dreams,
yeah,
mad on aeroplanes. And I joined the YTS in 85 with British Airways, and I became permanent staff. And it was actually when I became very, very ill that I had to medically retire.
Right.
So that means that when compensation is paid, they would take into account my career against all the odds, which I got. And yeah, some of the horrors that have happened along the way.
Yeah.
And as we know in our community, you get labelled, and the discrimination we face, it's horrific.
It stays with you, doesn't it?
I've been in hospital where a junior nurse basically told me there was nothing wrong with me. And I said to him, do you actually know what's wrong with me? And he said, no. And I was, right, well, I've got full-blown AIDS, I'm a severe haemophiliac, and you're constantly judged.
Do you think they've gone far enough with this? I know there's more to come, isn't there, with this interim payment and more?
Yeah, the inquiry is still hearing evidence.
Yeah.
The final report, we hope, will be sometime at the beginning of next year. And the team that Sir Brian Langstaff has built, they are amazing. I mean, they've shown us so much care and compassion, which we're not used to.
Yeah.
You know, when you've been treated like dirt all your life and somebody comes along and cuddles you,
yeah,
you know, it's like, what? It's alien. But the evidence they've heard, last week they were hearing about people's medical records. Now, you think with data protection, you know, they'd be safe. No, there's medical records gone missing, there's bits taken out, there's been mysterious fires, floods. I mean, we've had everything but the parting of the seas when it comes to medical records, and nobody seems to know anything about it.
It's taking responsibility, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So I do believe that the people who made decisions,
yeah,
literally life and death for all of us, not just the haemophilia community, for anyone who was touched with HIV, hepatitis viruses, they made decisions, but nobody ever asked, well, hang on, why are these people dying? Why are these people being harmed in our care?
Yeah.
They just carried on. And I think it's plain. It's, well, because it was the homosexuals, because it was the disabled, nobody cares.
The minority,
nobody bothered about.
Yeah.
I don't think it will be said in those words, but I have every confidence and faith in the inquiry. And I think we are getting to the truth.
Yeah, slowly. Process, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's been 4 years of the inquiry going on, and it's actually been over 40 years that we've been campaigning.
God.
So, you know, it's all of my adult life I've been campaigning.
Yeah.
And the one thing I'm proud of out of this, I'm the world's first LGBT ambassador for haemophilia and contaminated blood. But that's enabled me now, with an official role, to be able to reach out to organisations and others, and we're visible.
Yeah.
I've been trying for equality and recognition that there are LGBT people with brain disorders, and the Haemophilia Society have taken that on board, and I take my hat off to them because they've really been supportive.
Which is what you need, isn't
which
it?
Which we've needed for a long time. Yeah. But it could, for me, I think it sets the blueprint for a lot of other charities that they focus on the disability, but not the people. They're not recognising that we're made up of all these wonderful people. Yeah. And, you know, that all that gets ignored.
And different experiences and a different way of,
yes.
of coping yeah. with things.
Yeah. Facing mental health and discrimination yeah. that they're not even aware of
yeah.
because they don't speak to them as people. So it's opened up a lot of things. And, yeah.
What do you think, so your hopes for the future then?
My hope is that the inquiry report will give us the writing, it will show that justice has been done.
Yeah.
So that's all I want. You can pay millions and millions of pounds in money. It won't give me back my health. It won't give me back my career. It won't bring back my friends and all those little boys. But it goes to some way of the recognition of the harm done. So that's crucial. For me, going forward, I would like to use the report as a learning tool so I can then, again, expand on my ambassadorial role.
Yeah.
Speak to medical professionals, other organisations, and it's by talking that we learn. And hopefully, by speaking out and educating people, we can make sure, all of us, that this never happens again.
Yeah.
We've seen things with monkeypox and COVID, how all of a sudden divisions are made again, and the same things we heard back in the 80s are very good. So some things have changed, some things we've got a long way to go, but I hope by actually telling people the truth and it being there as fact,
yeah.
we can go out and tell people what actually did happen, and that will be our strongest tool.
And having ambassadors like you, because I mean, you're so passionate when you're talking. And I remember last time you came on, we were all blown away, actually, because you were so passionate about it. And that was such an amazing... It's amazing for you to come on and talk about it and just keep us updated. So it'd be great for you to come back on when the inquiry's finished, really, or it's been done, you can read it and complete it. So
thank you.
That'd be good.
Yeah, I'll do that.
I was going to say, anyone's been affected by, is there anywhere they can get in contact with? Is there any emails or websites?
Yes, so my recommendation is anybody who had a blood transfusion in the 1970s through to 1991,
yeah.
speak to your GP and ask if you've had a blood transfusion or ask for a test for hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And HIV as well, if you wish. If you do believe that you could be eligible for support, then you can look on the internet for the Infected Blood Inquiry or the England Infected Blood Support Scheme.
Right.
I can be contacted across social media at Haemosexual or the Haemophilia Society.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it definitely, I think what we actually need is a national screening program so that with treatments today, we can actually eradicate things. And
yeah.
Working with the UNAIDS project here in Brighton, we're so close to seeing the end of hopefully new transmissions of HIV, and we can't go backwards now.
No, and there's so many amazing things happening, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Mark.
Bye. Speak to you soon.
Radio Reverb. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the HIV Hour on 97.2 FM DAB. And also available on podcast. So I'm going to come in with my story from around the world. And this story is coming to us from the States. And it's prevention strategies are critical as diabetes rates rise in patients living with HIV. So adults with HIV have a greater risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared with someone never diagnosed with HIV. However, medications used to treat diabetes don't always control blood sugar as well for someone with HIV. So identifying factors associated with diabetic risk that are similar to the general population, as well as those unique to HIV, can help clinicians provide better preventative care for patients. This study that's recently been published in Physicians Weekly sought to examine the incidence of type 2 diabetes among people with HIV and the related risk factors. They conducted a retrospective cohort study at an academic HIV clinic in the southern United States, obtaining EMR data on demographics and clinical characteristics. We studied over 40,000 eligible patients with available EMR data to who's received care in the HIV treatment clinics, she explained, to understand the role of the various risk factors play in current era. We limited our investigation to a 10-year period from 2008 to 2018. And the research defined diabetes using three categories: AIC1 values equal or greater than 6.5%, and at least 30 days apart diabetic diagnosis in the EMRA or exposure to diabetes medication. Now, they were surprised to see a rapid increase in diabetic incidence, just prevalent in those 10 years, and they continue to increase, and the increasing trajectory of diabetes and burden people with HIV highlights the critical need for access to diabetic prevention care for this population. The researchers identified 252 cases of diabetes among the 4,000 people with HIV. Diabetes increased from 1.4% per 1,000 persons to 1.55% per 1,000 persons over that 10-year period. And it included liver disease, steroid exposure, and other factors included in CD4 counts and the duration of HIV infection and exposure to non-statin lipid-lowering therapy. And I knew there was going to be a word I couldn't say, dyslipidemia. So it just shows that obviously that there is a rise in definitely a rise in diabetic cases, and it's clear to see that people with HIV are being affected more by this. So obviously it's something that we really need to keep an eye on, because we don't want an outbreak of type 2 diabetes where those cases can be, you know, stopped. It's another important thing for us to keep an eye on.
Is it caused by the virus or actually the medication?
Well, that's the thing, Josh. They say that there could be things in the medication that cause the diabetes to be triggered. There's type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes. I have type 1 diabetes, which is insulin dependent. Type 2 can be diet controlled. So that's why you can get rid of type 2 diabetes as well. You know, you can get it to the point where it doesn't need any treatment. So it would be great for that to be able to happen, you know, rather than people have to be taking even more medication, even more drugs, you know. Something we need to keep an eye on.
It was just before COVID, I was on an HIV and aging study called Poppy Study, which is based in Brighton and other centres around the UK. And they discovered I had an impaired glucose tolerance, which is sort of the early stages of diabetes diagnosis. So they sent me to the diabetes doctor without actually saying that I had diabetes. It was still early. And he said, oh, if you were on these certain antiretrovirals, you're more than likely to become.
Yeah.
So they sent me to a pre-diabetes training course, which sort of taught me how to, you know, cut down on the white carbs and eat more healthy and things like that. And the hidden products. And thankfully, you know, when I after a period of time, my blood was up a lot better. So, yeah, without a doubt, the medication. He did name a particular drug, but I can't quite remember it. I don't want to get anyone into trouble by naming the wrong drug. But yeah, certainly some medication. So yeah, people living with HIV are at higher risk of developing. But you know, like you know, as Stephen said, you know, you're able to hopefully reverse it or control it with diet and lifestyle changes, exercise. So yeah, now well spotted, Stephen.
As we get older, these things are starting to happen, aren't they? These the different things, aren't they? So,
More prone.
Yeah. David.
Yes. So I've got an international story. So this is regarding PrEP, and this is a story from Kenya. So the headline of the story is "Using PrEP During Pregnancy Is Safe for Children." So across 20 mother and child health clinics in Kenya, a total of nearly 4,500 pregnant women were studied, and those that took PrEP that had no sort of adverse effects to either themselves or the children, even after birth, postpartum. So that's good news. So that PrEP is such an effective tool at eradicating HIV, and it's nice to know that pregnancy is not a complication, and it's not a complication for pregnancy.
So much needed, isn't it, David, in that situation? So much needed.
And also, this is from another part of the world where access to PrEP is so important, because there are other things that are more difficult to get hold of.
I think I saw a story. I didn't read it. I just saw the headlines that in Myanmar, is it? They're introducing PrEP now there. So it's happening around in different countries that find it hard to get hold of PrEP. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think globally, I know the World Health Organization are really pushing countries to catch up with putting the money into the UNAIDS funds to eradicate HIV by 2030. I was reading earlier today that they're sort of like $18 billion short, but countries are stepping up, and Germany, I think, announced another €1 billion to be put into the fund to help the global fight, not just within the developed world, but to push it out to everybody that needs it.
So I've got two stories. I don't know whether I think you said earlier this first story should be for Halloween. Well, I'm going to read it now. So this comes from Medical Express, and it's mucus-based lubricant proves highly effective against HIV and herpes. So this is a cow mucus that provides the basis for synthetic polyphylactic gel. Developed, I don't know where this is, but it's KTH Royal Institute of Technology. I think it's somewhere in Asia, I think. So the lubricating gel has proved 70% effective in lab tests against HIV and 80% in herpes. The tests conducted in a lab on several types of cells. So it's quite early days yet, isn't it? So Hong Ji Yan, so that sounds like it could be somewhere in Asia, who is the biomaterial researcher, says the promising results raise hope that when it becomes available as a product, the gel could help reverse troubling trends in the spread of sexually transmitted infections. More than 1 million STIs are acquired every day worldwide. Most of these are asymptomatic, according to World Health Organization. The disease caused by HIV, as for AIDS, the disease caused by HIV, it remains a significant global epidemic, which affects adolescent girls, young women, and who are twice as likely as men to contract HIV as their male counterparts, according to UniAIDS. Mm-hmm. This lubricant is derived from mucin. I've got that right. A main component of mucus, which is produced in the human body. The reason the gel is so effective at stopping HIV and herpes is the natural complexity of the mucin molecules without the risk of side effects or development of resistance, as with other antiviral compounds. So it's very difficult to achieve with a polymer made from scratch, he says, this researcher. Sorry, I'm just looking at your faces. You're wincing.
I won't have any tea tonight. Give it this.
It's Cam, yeah. I think you're doing trials of Cal mucus. Yeah, that's how I get it. That's how I see it. Anyway, in our body, mucin molecules can bind and trap virus particles, which clear naturally through active mucus turnover. Is that blowing your nose?
Yeah.
The synthetic gel replicates this self-healing function, which is a key material property that enables mucus lymphocyte and prophylaxis against infection. So this gel could help more people take greater control of their sexual health, offer protection when condom protection is not available option. So this is a lubricant, isn't it? It's like so it's based, they're doing the trials on, obviously, yeah, I can see what's doing it for. So it offers protection when condom protection is not available. And also could be a backup. So the mucin in the gel also helps to dampen the activation of immune cells. And that's important because activated immune cells stimulates HIV replication. So there. Yeah, so what do you think about that?
Yeah, definitely not having any tea. Yeah. So when I talk to my young people about when you use a condom, the best possible protection is water-based lubrication, I can now go in and say, and you can also use, because Josh said...
I mean, they're shocked enough when
I say water-based lubrication, don't use your mum's olive oil. They're shocked enough when I say that, you know.
That's not.
No, it's not. No, it's just interesting how we're developing different things. So I suppose if you use a new lubricating gel that can stop the virus.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing, really, isn't it?
No, it is.
It is
amazing, yeah.
Doesn't matter where it comes from?
No, as long as it does the job in it.
Mm. Yeah, I remember as a beekeeper, I read a paper on, they discovered something in bee stings was effective as a vaginal virucide.
Oh, wow.
I think they took the sting part out of it. Obviously, you don't want to...
No, they're a bit painful.
I'm swollen.
Oh, Sue, you're wincing.
I know. Ooh, and I love
these. I don't think we're going to have anything for the show tomorrow.
It's amazing how these things come from nature, and we can use nature to fight nature.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So the other story is, I saw this again in the news. How painting with, gay blood can tackle HIV stigma. So this is from America. Nearly 40 years ago, the US Food and Drug Administration put a lifetime ban on the use of blood donations. Now, it's changed here, hasn't it, in the UK? How long has that been now? I know we've talked about it on the show, haven't we?
Gosh.
Was it 20? I wrote down 14th of June, 2021, that it was.
Yeah, it's definitely been. That sounds right, Josh.
So in America, it's 40 years for blood donations for men who have sex with men. This act is discriminating, obviously, and homophobic, and also aids in a blood shortage, which we know about. So this new project is from a premium denim designer called Mother.
Mother?
Who is launching the Gay Blood Collection.
Right.
So that's going to be this month at New York Fashion Week. So the collection of articles are a proactive and progressive stride towards ending the stigma surrounding gay blood. Not like saying gay blood, but So they created a unique ink from MSM, men who have sex with men's blood, in collaboration with pigment artist Stuart Semple to raise awareness of this issue. So there's things like gay blood acrylic paint, blood fountain pen paint, gay blood screen printing ink. So it's, yeah. So how it works is...
Just for a second, how do you guys feel about that?
I think it's a bit macabre, but it's nothing...
Just interested. How does that make you...
It's kind of... It's raising awareness, isn't it, at the end?
Yeah, I get that.
I suppose the fact that, you know, it hopefully will break down those barriers of there being a fear of of blood that comes from somebody that's LGBT or that's HIV positive, you know. So it's interesting. It's an interesting one, isn't it?
I think for us, because our ban's been lifted, we can't see it. So if you know that this ban's still there and you can see it's discriminating and it's homophobic, you know, it's homophobic, and you have to do something that's quite drastic and out there a little bit. It's it's a bit dodgy.
Controversial, exactly. Controversial.
That's the word. It's controversial. Yeah,
we have to sort of step above the parapet of whatever it's called. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Josh, you've just talked about cow mucus as a lubricant. So really, really, blood, you know, the blood doesn't worry me at all.
Yeah.
Hey, it's a funny old world.
It is.
Anyway, so it works by using small traces of blood, which is safe to use, wear and handle. So also they're collaborating with, I think these American public figures like, is it Gus Kenworthy?
Yeah.
And Daniel Ortez, to help them draw attention to the collection. I think I read that Gus Kenworthy, is he an Olympian or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, you know, it's just to air it, isn't it, and get it out there in different ways.
Mm-hmm. So. It's bringing attention to things perhaps we wouldn't dare think about, you know, or some people wouldn't dare think about. So, yeah.
That's what we do on this show.
That's what we do. We're very controversial. We say it how it is.
I've got to say, actually, I've got my little updates on my... My bottom. More controversy.
Tell us more.
I don't know. I had my ejection, didn't I, last time?
Yeah.
So I had my second ejection and I got a sore posterior. That only lasted a week, so it just goes off then.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fine now. Doesn't seem to be any side effects. So I've got... Yeah. Don't have to go back till another 2 months. November's my next one, so...
Brilliant.
Have you heard about yours? Because you said you were going to do it, weren't you?
What it is, I may be going on, it's called it's not a trial, it's a study. It's called the Alana study, and it's about injections in women, injectable HIV medication in women. And I'm always banging on about there's not enough trials for women to do. So I thought, well, put your head above the pulpit, as one would say again, and I've gone in for it. So I'm just waiting. I'd have to transfer my care from where I am in Worthing over to Brighton. So that's just all being sorted. And hopefully I possibly could start, if everything goes well, before Christmas, but I'll keep you posted. So
Do you get an incentive, I heard?
That's why I'm doing it. No, it's not. No, you know, to have an injection in my posterior every month, I think I'd need more than what they're saying, but I'm doing it obviously for other reasons. But this is a monthly one. But it's a specific study in women. So no, I'm looking forward to it. I hope everything goes well. They're just checking, obviously, my stats and bloods from the years and making sure, you know. So yeah, and I'll keep you posted.
I mean, really, all of our listeners, if you are aware of any studies or research that's going on in your area, it really does help people like ourselves to help scientists understand HIV and managing science.
Definitely.
I saw a study in London that I was interested in doing.
What was that, David?
Right, about anal cancer, but I'd have to go to London. But the benefit of doing some of these studies is you get access to medication before they become on sort of generally.
Yes.
Or you may discover something about your health which wouldn't normally happen when you start showing symptoms. my pre-diabetes, I would have become diabetic. Exactly. If I had been on that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it really is worthwhile to take part, and you wouldn't be doing anything unsafe. Doctors, do everything by the book and follow the
average
guidelines and ethics. We'd love to hear your stories.
Yeah.
Now, how can people contact us? Who's going to say it's the HIVHour@gmail.com. That's our email. So we've got a Twitter account, which is HIV_hour.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good place to message us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, please do. So another thing from THT is it's coming up to be doing some Living Well webinars this autumn. So it's work and skills workshops, mm-hmm. if you're interested. It's all interactive. So the sessions are hosted over Zoom. So it includes a mixture of information, small group discussions to share ideas and learning. So the first one is free as well, so which mm-hmm. is good. The first one is understanding skills and setting goals, and that's on the 28th of September. On the 5th of October, successful CV writing, which is really important if you're looking for mm-hmm. work.
Mm-hmm.
12th of October is the application forms, and the 19th of October is interview techniques. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested and you want to book or any more information, you can go to tht.org.uk/work and skills, and mm-hmm. all that's on there. There's also a stigma empowerment program, which is a 2-day course running on Saturday 24th mm-hmm. of September and Saturday the 1st of October, and that's 11 till 4. Lunch and refreshments are provided. So this program is focused on equipping participants with the knowledge and skills to effectively navigate HIV stigma and living well with it. So that's the program. It is available to anyone living with HIV. This is in London, actually.
Yes.
Receiving their care in London. So mm-hmm. Again, contact THT, livingwell@tht.org.uk. That's the email address, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Also, there's something else as well. There's Chemsex. Mm. And that's the next group is on the 27th of October, so it's still over a month away. And this is a 6-week program.
Yeah.
And that's available for anyone looking to make a meaningful change to their chems use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's confidential, non-judgmental online group, and they explore your relationship with chems, how to use most safely, and how to protect yourself and others. And that starts on Thursday, the 27th of October, and that's every Thursday
for
6 weeks.
Can I just add on to that, Josh? These are really popular training sessions. So if you're interested, really, really connect with THT Ship Street office. They're amazing sessions. We've done loads of them, and they're really great. You know, if you want to do them, so I'm sort of piping that up a bit, because they really are a great sort of training thing you can do.
Yeah. And so if you want a book or more information, go to tht.org.uk/chemsex, or you can email them chemsexsupport@tht.org.uk. So yes, anything else? Any other community news?
Having their service user forum on the 24th of September.
Could you say that again, David? Because you went off when you said...
Yeah, the Sussex Beacon are having their service user forum on the Saturday, 24th of September. So if you want to get involved in that, if you are a current or previous Sussex Beacon service user, you're able to offer your feedback and share it with other service users. The email address. The email address is forum@sussexbeacon.org.uk.
All right, well, nice to see everyone, and thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Sounds good.
Good night, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Take care.
And you.
HIVR is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news, and views on living positively with the virus.